Bunch on radio station KPFT HD2 channel. You can also hear this program and may be listening to this program on executionwatch.org. You can get there by going to kpft.org or theprisonshow.org, and all of those are linked to executionwatch.org. This is a live performance. Tonight, scheduled is Danielle Simpson, and he is at the age of the offense. He was 21 years old. He was born October 26th, 1979, so that would mean he is now 40 years old.
Yeah, right.
And with me in the studio is Jim Skelton. What is going on is Elizabeth is going out to reach Dennis Longmire in Huntsville to determine if the process has begun. There were pending issues before the courts up to about 15 minutes ago. We hope that a stay is granted and the show can be canceled or severely diminished. But since we're in the studio, we'll probably go on for the hour if there's an execution or not. But at this point, we do not know about that. Jim Skelton and I get together every time someone gets executed, and Jim tells us what happened in the case, and then we go through a legal history of the case. Jim, what happened in this case?
What happened, Ray, as you well know, is Daniel Simpson was a 21-year-old kid at the time, and he was living with his mother and sisters. And apparently there was an elderly lady named Geraldine Davidson who lived about two blocks from him, and he used her house kind of like an ATM machine. Whenever he wanted something, he'd break in the house and steal something. And he had broken in two times before and stole things. And on this particular evening, he asked his 13-year-old cousin, a kid by the name of Edward McCoy, he was married to a woman named Jennifer Simpson, to go with him to the house, and we're going to break in. So all three of them walk down to this lady's house. They knock on the door. No one answers it. And they go back to the garage, and Daniel Simpson breaks open a window. His wife crawls through, lets them in. And they're in the house, guys, and got money, jewelry, and whatnot. And they'd been in the house about 15 minutes when Ms. Davidson returned to the house.
Mm-hmm.
When she arrived, Simpson came up behind her, held a knife to her throat, and they put her on the floor. His wife taped up her legs. He put duct tape over her mouth and over her arms, and he put a pillowcase over her head. Then he got her purse and took all the money and stuff out of her purse and got her car keys. They then take her and throw her in the trunk of her own car.
This woman's 84 years old.
She's an 84-year-old woman, was a church organist in the city of Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
She's also the church organist. So what happened after they put her in the trunk of the car, you got somebody coming in?
Well, go ahead.
Okay.
Finish.
Okay.
They put her in the trunk of the
car. Then they drove from there to about 15 miles away to a town named Grapevine. And on the way, they bought hamburgers, and they were trying to buy drugs. They ended up buying some marijuana, tried to get crack cocaine, couldn't get it because they were getting rid of some of the stuff that's stolen.
She's in the back of the car?
She's in the trunk of the car.
Let's hold it there. Rick?
Ray.
Oh, Dennis.
Yes.
What's going on in Huntsville?
Well, all of the witnesses have proceeded into the main prison unit, which is, of course, our signal that the execution is going forward as scheduled. We're out here on the corner. There are six of us regular vigilers and about seven members of Daniel's family who are here. His cousin is willing to talk with you if you'd like to speak with her. Her name
okay.
is Christina.
Tina?
Christina, yes. Here,
Christina.
I'm going to give her my
okay.
phone.
Put Christina on.
Christina, this is Ray Hill. Just on. There you go.
Hello.
Christina, we are on the air on KPFD HD2 channel. Tell me, your name is Ms. Walker?
Yes, sir.
And what is your relationship with Danielle?
Danielle is my first cousin.
Did you know him all of your childhood?
We grew up together. We had a wonderful time in life, period. Short times we shared together because I was 14 and he was 20 when he got incarcerated, and
there are other family members there.
Yes, there's other family members here.
And did someone go in as a witness from the family?
the witnesses, his sisters, his mother and father, couldn't witness what was going to happen to him today, so they left. They were here, they spent the day with him, but they couldn't witness it, so they left.
Okay. Well, I imagine it's cool in Huntsville at this hour.
Okay.
I imagine it's cold in Huntsville right now.
It's very terrible right now. Okay. We know that they're going through everything, and there's no stopping it. So,
okay. Well, thank you. Put Rick back on. Put Dennis back on, please.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
You still there, Ray?
Yeah, I'm still here. Dennis, we're going to go back to Jim and continue to tell the story of the case and the legal history. If anything else develops, let us know.
I will. Thank you for thank you for everything you do.
Thank you, Dennis. Appreciate your loyalty and vigilance.
Okay, you're welcome.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. That was Professor Dennis Longmire, professor of criminal justice at Sam Houston State University, who is a frequent vigil member outside the death chamber every time Texas does one of its numerous executions. So now let me go back to Jim. Jim, we've had a burglary that was interrupted by the homeowner coming in. She was bound, hogtied, taped up, and thrown in the back of her own car.
Right.
And so they go somewhere else to score some drugs?
Well, they went to a little town called Grapeland, about 10 miles out of Palestine. And on the way, they bought some marijuana, tried to buy some crack cocaine, and were not successful. They went over there to visit Danielle's aunt and his cousin Shay. She's a young girl. When they get to Grapeland, Danielle goes out and opens the trunk and shows Shay the lady in the back of the trunk. She's a pillowcase over her head, and she's taped up. And the lady begged for medicine. He told her to shut up and slam the trunk down. And then from there, they went. They ate some hamburgers and French fries. And apparently Danielle was a member of a gang called the Crips in East Texas. And he goes to some of his buddies, and this is, I presume, in Palestine, the opinion doesn't say. And he kind of showed her off to the dear various friends of his that he had this hostage in the back of the trunk. And during this process, he bumped into his 15-year-old brother, 15-year-old brother's name, Lionel Simpson. And so his brothers realized that his older brother, Danielle, had a hostage. And he said, "We got to kill her. You've got to kill this lady." And so Danielle agreed, so they didn't drive to the Nueces River, get her out of the car. And what happened, the cousin, the young 13-year-old cousin, ended up testifying for the state. So the cousin said they chucked her on the ground, and they beat on her. For what reason, I don't know. And then he said that Danielle took a running start and kicked her in the face. Mm. And then they picked up the lady's body, beating Danielle and his brother, Lionel, and threw her into the river, and she drowned in the river. Then later on, somebody saw her body floating by. And what happened is when the case went to trial...
when they were caught, they were in possession of items from the house.
They didn't say in the opinion. They never said that. And what happened, the cousin, the 13-year-old cousin, is the one that testified against them. And there never was much of a doubt that he was the one that committed the crime. And at the punishment hearing, it was pretty gruesome because apparently... he had beaten up, over the period of time, most of his family members. Mm-hmm. He and his sister got into a tiff because Danielle was accused of sexually molesting one of her daughters. Mm-hmm. And they got into a big argument. He went outside and got a brick and broke all the windows out of the car and hit her. And there was testimony in trial that he had beat up most of his family members from time to time. And there were also testimony of numerous other burglaries that he had committed with his brother. And they seemed to have a pattern. They would spray paint the inside of a house and put gang symbols on it, like the kids oftentimes do. And one of the things in Palestine that really did hurt him, he wrote, "White people must die." And you can imagine how that went over with an East Texas
jury. Yeah.
Yes, and you can imagine after he beat and kicked an 84-year-old church organist in the face before he drowns her, how that went over. And so there's the testimony of numerous burglaries that he'd committed before. He had received a deferred adjudication for the indecency case when he had tried to molest his sister's daughter. He was on deferred for that. And like I say, there never was much of a question about his guilt. The question was one of punishment. a psychiatrist testified and went through him and said he was a sociopath. He had all the makings of a sociopath and be a danger to the future. And what's interesting about that, as you well know, a lot of kids that are fairly young have been diagnosed as sociopaths, but strange enough, a lot of them grow out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, they had a sociopath that testified. And what the defense did to counter that, they never were able to prove any type of childhood abuse that he went through, but they did prove up a couple of things. Number one, that Danielle's father was very physically abusive to his mother when he was a child. That might have had some impact on him.
And he was a witness to
that. Right, and he was a witness to that. And also, he had had several head blows. And he had been knocked out in a football game and was out for an hour and a half. And one doctor claimed he had two blood clots, what they call subdural hematomas. That pressure in his brain that might have affected his impulse and his thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a psychologist, of course, that testified he was not a sociopath. And, of course, with the testimony about the, you know, the kill all whites and what they had been abusing this elderly lady and robbing her house, burglarizing her house numerous times, that was all a jury in Palestine needed, and they assessed the death penalty. Plus, they were also able to prove, why these guys do this, I've never understood. They get tattoos to show they're a member of a gang. And what they don't realize at punishment hearings is that they'll have gang experts come in and look at the tattoos. Not only would let that expert testify about gangs, they'll also testify all the activities these people are involved in, which is, as far as future dangerousness, it pretty well kills you.
Yeah.
Because they let that expert testify, although Danielle might not have been involved in those activities, that testimony.
The typical behavior of this gang is.
Right, and they'll tell all the stuff they do, and it's never passing out Bibles or doing stuff like that. It's always dealing drugs and beating up and killing people. And so based on that evidence, they assess the
death.
And
there's no problem with that evidence getting in.
They, of course, have consistently let it in because what they did a number of years ago, they amended the statute on a punishment. What they basically said that any issue relating to future dangerousness that the judge considers himself, he himself considers to be relevant, they're going to let in. And obviously, being a member of a gang would have some relevance whether you'd be a danger to the future, especially if the gang's a violent gang. And they've had no problem ever getting that evidence in, and the way they tie it to the defendant are the tattoos on his body. It went to the Court of Criminal Appeals, and they had no problem affirming it.
The jury didn't have a lot of problems coming up with the conviction and punishment in this case.
They didn't pause very long at all. And what happened after the case was affirmed, the Atkins case came down, and Atkins is a Supreme Court case that says it violates the Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment provision to execute retarded people. So they went into the state court on a writ claiming he was retarded, and the Court of Criminal Appeals pretty well flushed that. He then goes to federal court in Beaumont, the Eastern District of Texas, and files it in Beaumont, and Beaumont denies his retardation claim without a hearing. Fifth Circuit kicks it back and says, hold a hearing on him, and they did hold a hearing. After hearing, the district court judge then said he's not retarded. And so at that time, Simpson put his case on appeal. And this is where kind of the case gets a little screwy. At that point, Danielle starts writing a series of letters to the Court of Appeals, Fifth Circuit, saying, I want to withdraw my appeals. Go ahead and kill me. I can't stand this plus blasting death row.
Mm-hmm.
And he started writing these series of letters. I don't want to appeal this. If I can't be free, I want to die. And sent a series of letters like that. And so what happened is lawyer intervened, and you get the impression from reading the opinions that it was not with Danielle's permission. The lawyer intervened and filed a motion to keep the case on appeal. And then he filed a motion to withdraw for obvious reasons because he didn't agree with his client withdrawing the appeal.
You would have to if you had a conflict with your client.
Right. So they let the lawyer withdraw, and they said, okay, what we're going to do, we're going to send it back down to the Beaumont District Court to see whether he's competent to waive his right to appeal.
Okay.
So they kick it back to the Federal District Court. They hold a hearing. And what they do with that, it's not whether you're competent like a normal competency hearing. It's whether or not you knowingly want to withdraw your appeal. Like Gary Gilmore, remember?
Sure.
He wanted to withdraw his appeals. They had a hearing. They said, look, this guy is perfectly rational. He can withdraw his appeal if he wants to. If that's what he wants to do, it's his choice. And so at this point, all the appeals were off. And his family then intervened as amicus, they call it a friend of the court, and tried to intervene, ask him to reinstate the appeals. And initially, the Fifth Circuit flushed it pretty much, said, you know, we're going to deny that. And what's currently pending hasn't been answered yet. The family filed a second motion asking the Fifth Circuit to reconsider the fact that he's foregone his right to appeal. And that's been his mother and his aunts and some of his family members. Danielle never joined that deal to have his appeals removed. His stance has been pretty much, if I can't be free, I'm going to be dead. And the law says if you're competent to make that decision, they will certainly grant your wish. And that's where it currently stands now.
So how long has he been on death row? 12 years?
About 12 years.
About 12 years.
Because, see, it kept flipping. It went to the Fifth Circuit, and then they had a hearing in the Court of Criminal Appeals on a writ that was pretty extensive. And the case bounced around for a number of years from the district court to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit kept kicking it back to hold a hearing, made them hold a hearing on mental retardation, and they ruled against him. And kicked it back and made them hold a hearing on whether or not he was competent to waive an appeal. They had a hearing on that. So it's bounced around the federal system some length of time. But he's gotten no relief from it.
He hasn't changed from his position of being a volunteer, basically.
No. What really hurt him, truthfully, a lot of it, you hurt yourself by doing this. When the writ was filed in state court, one of his claims then that he was mentally retarded. But what he did, and I'm sure without advice of counsel, he sent a brief showing why they should grant the writ with a whole bunch of points of error, which doesn't indicate he's too retarded.
And somebody had to find those points of error.
Somebody had to. It's either
whether they're real or not, alleging them as a process.
Right. And it doesn't look like you're too retarded when you can do that. And so they said, of course, as you well know, they wouldn't give him hybrid representation, but that certainly did a lot. See, here's what happens to so many of these people, especially if they tend to be a little bit sociopathic. Lawyers have seen this. We have often said there is a killer gene in people who are sociopathic or narcissistic. It's kind of like, the best way I can parallel it, sometimes when people have terrible mental handicaps, like hydrocephalics or some terrible mental problem, they will also have accompanying health problems that guarantee they won't live too long.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of mother's nature, a way of getting rid of that bad gene. And a lot of people have the theory that you have a killer gene in a person who's sociopathic, and they do everything they can to make sure they get the maximum punishment. And Theodore Bundy in Florida is a classic example. Because I promise you, he did everything he could to guarantee he got caught. He did everything he could once he got caught. He fired most of his lawyers and tried to argue his own case on two different occasions. And he did everything in trial that he could possibly do to make sure he got the death penalty. And we've always kind of nicknamed that a killer gene, that people do these nutty, and you have no control over them. For example, in the Theodore Bundy case, the worst part of evidence, he had bit the girls on the buttocks. And so what they did to show this was the first time they used teeth bite identification, they peeled back his lips and showed his teeth that looked like an animal. And they blew that photograph up. Theodore Bundy insisted on cross-examining the lawyer, the policeman who made the scene of the crime. And he went over in minute detail about pieces of brain on the ceiling. He just kind of seared that in the jury's mind how brutal the killing was. And all the time he was doing this, behind him was that photograph, that big, enlarged photograph of his teeth open like an animal. The jury wanted to kill him. He got the death penalty in that case. He got a second death penalty when he fired all of his lawyers, and the only person left to argue his case was a law student who had been licensed less than a year. And so his case, I'm not saying it's like Bundy, but it's similar in the sense.
This guy's been volunteering for years.
He has been begging to get killed. And when you, you claim you're retarded, do that foolish stuff of sending in a brief, which indicates, you know, he's got, of course, this is not surprising that a lot of lawyers have withdrawn off his case because he simply won't listen. And his letters to the courts about, he would underline, I want to die, I want them to kill me. And he raved on about how bad the prison system was, and he wanted to die. And apparently they're going to accommodate his wish.
Right now that's probably what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not really that much appellate history of this case. It was
the only two issues on appeal. The first issue was when Atkins came out, the case on mental retardation. They went back and tried to claim mental retardation. And that didn't work because that's a real, real difficult thing, proved a thing on appeal. You got to prove they had a IQ under 70, no adaptive skills, that this started when they were in school. And usually the school records don't back up that claim. And then the next issue in this case was his competency to waive his right to appeal. And that's not really a major issue. They just simply have him examined and say, have you got sense enough to realize what you're doing? If you know what you're doing, then they're going to let you withdraw your appeal, just like Gary Gilmore did.
So, you know, we get a lot of these cases. We should have had an execution watch last night, but the fellow, after getting his last meal, got a stay within 2 hours of his execution, and there will be a hearing in about a month on that. For further progression of that, I talked to his attorney, Lee Wilson, this afternoon. Mm-hmm. Lee's a fine little lawyer. And Lee had said that this was a relief and he was glad to have the 30 days. There were some issues that he wanted to work in addition to the one that's immediately obvious, the mental health of his client. And this gave him a little time to do that. But at some future date, Lee will be on the show. I hope it's not on the occasion of the execution of his client, because lawyers do get emotionally involved in these things.
See, that's going to be a hard row to hoe, because as strange as this is, one of the paradoxes of capital punishment, if they're going to kill you, they want you to know that you're going to die.
Yeah.
And if you are delusional, like I know we were talking last night before the other show, there was a guy in Florida who was eating, wanted to hold his meal. He said, be right back.
Right.
He didn't know what the hell death
after, meant. After execution, he was going to come back right to his cell and finish the meal.
And so what the issue in the case they're having last night, the reason they got the stay, they claim that he's delusional. They claim that he believes that every morning his brother comes and picks
him. Well, he gets up in the morning, according to his cellmates, people in prison, death row. He gets up and dresses.
Mm-hmm.
And says his brother will be here to pick him up. Why is his brother running late? And you got him? No guy? No guy?
I spoke to Dennis, and he said there's no sign of movement. So we don't know if things have gone ahead or finished.
Dave? What about Dave?
I haven't spoken with Dave. But I've got a question for Jim, and that is that, Jim, when the judge that said it was okay for Daniel Simpson to have his wish to be executed, didn't he also say it was evident that he suffered from a mental illness of some kind, but that, you know, he was going to grant it anyway? I didn't quite understand that.
There's nothing that I read that says, see, a mental illness by itself is not sufficient. The mental illness has got to be several things. Number one, to be for a defense to a crime, you got to be so insane you don't know what you're doing is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't fit that qualification. And mental illness, you can be mentally ill but still realize that you're going to be executed. Because the issue that's in the case that they granted to stay on last night, he doesn't know that he's going to die. In Texas, like ever, this is just one of those bizarre things. They want you to damn well know why you're dying. They don't want you to be believing you're going to go to, you know, see fairies up in the sky. They want you to know we're going to kill you. And so if you're not competent to realize that you're going to be executed, not aware of that fact, they can't execute you. Because one of the real dilemmas, they haven't answered this question yet, there's a guy in Pennsylvania on death row. And if he takes medication, he's sane enough to execute. But if he doesn't take them, he's not. So his lawyer says, don't take the medication. And the big issue is, can they force him, stick it down his nose or different parts of his body, and make him take the medicine long enough to kill him?
Yeah, that case has been rocking and rolling for a long time.
Yeah. And so that's what the issue is. And the only thing I can see that may grant a stay in this case, it may have been that they're going to give some consideration. Maybe at the last moment he decided he does, in fact, want to appeal. Because up until this point, his lawyer intervened and asked that his desire to withdraw his appeal be removed. His family intervened, his next friend, on two different occasions to do that. But thus far, Danielle has not joined that. And it could very well be that he's joined that group and they're going to consider giving him the right to appeal.
Well, there were issues up until about 15 minutes before the execution time that were pending. However, when they kill somebody, there's a ritual going on. You have somebody up there in the little group observing the execution outside the death chamber. And the first thing they know that the execution is proceeding is, as Professor Dennis Longmar said, the witnesses cross the street. They go from the old TDCJ administration building into the Walls compound itself. And that is the witnesses in the media and the witnesses for the person about to be executed. Now, there are other witnesses there, then those are the witnesses there for the victim, and they come in a different way and are already in the death house before this ritual begins. But they cross the road in front of the demonstrators or the vigil, and so we know that the process is going on. We also knew going in that there were some pending issues of some court. Now, I don't know who has filed those. I don't know whether it was his attorney, his family, or who it was has filed it. Have we got Dave on the line? Dave? 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 Dave?
Hi, Ray.
Where are you?
Corner of Almeda and Holcomb.
Okay, we've got a little different situation here. The witnesses have crossed the street, which means that the process has begun. However, they're normally back about 6:20, and now it is almost 6:30, and neither the media witnesses nor the witnesses for the person to be actually Mr. Simpson, none of those have come out.
Uh-huh.
So the process is delayed.
Yeah.
For either some legal reason, or we had a delay one time because of finding a vein. They went to turn on the chemicals and the needle popped out, so they had to redo that.
Yeah.
But,
okay.
That right now everything is on hold, and I thought that was important to pass on to you. Who I'm talking to is Dave Atwood. And Dave is co-founder, officer of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And Dave, tell us something about what you're doing out there today and something about the organization.
Well, we're out here for another execution vigil. We have these down in addition to up in Huntsville, we have them around the state, and this is the Houston vigil. We have about 8 people here today, not a big crowd, but a faithful crowd, and one of the things that the question comes up every now and then, what value is this, but we have so many cars go by and see our signs and our banners and everything that I think it's really worthwhile, and by far the majority of people today gave us a thumbs up as to what we were doing, and So, it's just a little bit we can do to say that we don't agree with what's going on up in Huntsville today, and we're out here for every execution, although we do move it around different places in the city.
Okay, how do people get in touch with the organization by phone or by website so that they can keep aware of where you are holding a vigil and when?
Our website is tcadp.org, tcadp.org, and that has all the up-to-date information on our what's going on that we're aware of.
So TCABC is the acronym for Texas Coalition Against the Death Penalty.
Right, right.
Okay, Dave, and that's all we have to report at this point. If something else comes up, I will ring you back.
Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
And that was Dave Atwood of the Texas Coalition to Abolish Death Penalty. Normally we have Gloria Ruback with us. Gloria normally makes the trip up to Huntsville. She is not with us tonight. She went all the way up there yesterday only to find out after she got there that there was going to be no execution. And we actually celebrate those occasions. We thought about going ahead and doing a show for you last night because we had Leo Freeman in the studio, and Leo was the first person convicted of an execution sentence after the restoration of death penalty in Texas. I think that it got restored in June of 1971, and the next month he was convicted and sent to death row. He ultimately had his sentence commuted or changed and did a total of 38 years in Texas prison before he got out. He would have been a valuable guest, and we brought him in last night to talk about insane people that he had known on death row, because this guy is certainly behaving in a crazy way, scheduled to be executed until the last minute. Well, Jim, any general thoughts about the fact that we need to do these shows, even though sometimes the story is not a pretty one to listen to?
Well, you know, and I've said this before over and over again. If you're a death penalty advocate, you cannot, in most instances, ever discuss the facts. The facts are pretty horrible. And the facts in this case are pretty horrible.
You mean an advocate against the death
penalty? You're an advocate against the death penalty. And I think probably the most intelligent reasoning I've ever seen was a guy, Scott Thurlow, who used to be a U.S. attorney. And he wrote a op-ed piece for the New York Times, and he said he was the one that led the commission in Illinois, where they later commuted all the sentences
sure.
to life. And he said going in, he took a straw vote on who believed in the death penalty, and he himself believed in the death penalty.
I know that guy. I met him at a conference.
After they reviewed all those cases, he said he came to this conclusion that the facts in many cases merit the death penalty. The problem is we as society can't get it right. Because you can't get out the inherent unfairness, because people in rural areas will more likely kill somebody than someone in the metropolitan area. So you have a disparity between the different populations. People in Texas more likely get the death penalty than people in Vermont who commit mm-hmm. the same crimes. And interesting enough, rarely ever is a woman given the death penalty, although her crimes may be as heinous as what the men do. And he said that there's been too many instances of people being convicted. They probably didn't do it. So he said it's not that he doesn't believe in the death penalty, but we just haven't, as a society, learned to do it right.
Well,
it's not that they don't merit dying for their conduct, but he just simply says as a society, we can't do it.
Well, we have Rick Halpern. Rick, are you there?
I am.
Well, did you hear what Jim had to say?
No, I did not.
Okay, Jim was saying, recanting the experience in Ohio with one of the panelists that advised the governor there that unwound that whole ball of wax.
Illinois, right?
It's Illinois, in Illinois. And that the governor's in prison now, isn't he?
Right.
Okay.
Not for this. Though,
not for this,
something
for something else. And
well, being from Illinois is enough.
One of the most stalwart anti-execution activists that I know is Rick Halpern. Give Jim a set of ear goggles.
And I can hear him on that.
Okay. And Rick, you're on the air.
Hi there.
And how did you come to be an advocate for the end of executions?
I really got these views from my mom when I was being raised. I was it was instilled in me that life is sacred, that really nothing can justify the taking of life, that all people need dignity and manners regardless of what they have done. And I was exposed to a lot of violence in society in the 50s, just reading and seeing people angry. I just know that the killing people is no answer to any of society's problems. Guilty people have to be incarcerated, but killing people is just not an answer. It never has been, and it certainly isn't now.
Well, Rick, I've been reading your information for years. Of course, we know each other. Rick,
yes.
Rick is from Southern Methodist University in Dallas, and I'm the guy on the prison radio show. And so we've encountered one another for years and years and years. And Rick, let me give you an off-the-cuff idea of where I'm coming from. It's not that there is nobody who deserves killing, because I keep a list of people I think deserve killing next to my computer, and it includes a lot of high-ranking governmental officials. But what bothers me is that there are other lists, many with my name on it. And I don't know how we sort all that out. People do some horrible, nasty, evil, ugly, heinous things. And if you do that on such an enormous scale, they give you a medal to put on your uniform or wear in your suit lapel. But if you do that on an individual basis, they send you somewhere to get killed. That does not make sense to me at all.
Well, agreed. You know, it's clear that not all life is sacred in the sense that it is okay to kill people or to take life under some circumstances, self-defense, war, clearly in the name of national interest. And as you say, it is not okay for an individual to premeditatedly go and kill someone he or she just doesn't like. There are norms, but you know, I just don't think that anybody should be put to death. There are a lot of people, as you say, I agree, who do outrageous, heinous, vile crimes against innocent people in this society, and they definitely need to be kept away from you and me. The question isn't, should they be punished? The question is, what is the nature of that punishment?
Yeah, and the defendants of execution quickly say, well, what are you going to do, cut them loose? And the answer is, no, that was not on the slate anyway.
Exactly. Society can be protected without killing people.
I just got word from Elizabeth that the folks have crossed the road going back to the witness gathering space, so the process is complete. As of this moment, is the first news we have that Danielle Simpson, now age of about 40, has been executed by the state of Texas for an offense that occurred some 12 years ago. And on the radio with us is Rick Halpern, who is an activist at the and a professor at Southern Methodist University. And you're an advocate for human rights, equality, and you're concerned about the mental health side of this issue as well.
Absolutely. You know, it is mind-boggling to me that it is legal in this country to kill, for states to kill, persons who are not only mentally ill, but persons who are profoundly mentally ill. And we've seen that in this state and others, perhaps best expressed with the killing of Kelsey Patterson several years ago. But it's just shocking on mental health-related issues that the basic person in this country remains really uneducated about mental illness in general, and killing mentally ill people in particular.
Well, Rick, are we actually approaching getting there? I mean, the retardation ban that the Supreme Court issued, and now we have an argument over the definition of those terms. But at least they have said if you're severely mentally retarded, you can't be executed.
Right. That struggle took 13 years for states and people to become educated about the killing of retarded people. You know, the court used the Texas case of Johnny Paul Penry in 1989 to say it was okay to kill retarded people.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, in 2002, after a lot of education, a pro-death penalty Supreme Court reversed itself and said that an evolving standard of decency had emerged and we would no longer kill retarded people. And we are just now in the process of beginning that education in this country. So I think the killing of mentally ill people will continue, and I think it will sadly continue for years to come. But it will reach a point like we did on the issue of retardation where the court will say no more. But we're not at that point yet.
We're not at that point yet. I remember a decade ago, before we started doing Execution Watch, we've only started doing this show recently. Incidentally, an archive of tonight's show and your appearance on tonight's show will appear on executionwatch.org, and it's being broadcast live on that website now. As a matter of fact, I think most of our audience is through the Internet as opposed to listening to the HD2 channel because that equipment is not yet universal. But Winston Cochran, who is a fine, conscientious, young appellate lawyer, a decade ago came in and he said, they just executed my client. And he came on the next prison show and he said, he spoke in kind of a word salad. It looked like he could almost make sense out of what he said, but the words didn't work as sentences, ideas, or concepts. It was just words. And that person had just been executed, and the emotional impact on Winston was visible. He had tried everything he knew in his profession to do to save that severely mentally damaged person, and it didn't work. And at that time, they executed him, even though it was clear he had no concept of what was about to happen. I don't guess it was clear because he couldn't communicate. But something was wrong. And the state wants to make sure you know why you're being executed, but they're pretty loose in the definition of what it takes to stop that process.
And I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that once a person is condemned, the job of the state is to carry out that sentence. The job of the state is to kill these people. It is not the state's job to reopen trials or to raise issues regardless of what claims may be made. That is not the job of the state. The state has a long and miserable history, of course, of arguing at all costs that someone who is condemned should be killed, claiming as recently as last night, before he got a stay, that Mr. Elridge was faking. You know, the job is to kill these people, and in this particular state, they are very good at it.
The struggle will go on.
Rick, we're in here. Jim Skelton is our legal expert on this show, and he just would like to interject a question.
Sure.
Let me tell you one of the real practical problems.
Can you hear him?
Barely.
Okay, can you hear me okay now?
No, it's got to come through this microphone up here. Jim.
Change microphone.
Just come on. Just stand up and bring your microphone with you.
Okay,
and muffle is how we have to do that.
There we go. Is that all right now?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Thank you.
One of the practical problems as a lawyer, when you have a punishment hearing when somebody's already been found guilty, the evidence of people being insane or mentally ill oftentimes is incentive for a jury to execute them. That's one of those little strange things, because most jurors, if they think somebody will be dangerous if he doesn't take his medication, that may be a dangerous, there's no cure for his mental illness, it's an incentive to give the death penalty. That's how it works. It's kind of like the old argument is, I love my sheepdog, but he kills my sheep, therefore I have to put him down. And that's a real treacherous thing when you handle mental illness in front of a jury, because oftentimes that bounces back and it gives incentive on the part of the jury, especially if they're a little bit slow and not quite qualified to be retarded under our definition of being retarded, because they're not going to get any better. And so the jury knows that. And they also know if he doesn't take medication, he may snap again. And so what that does, that scares the hell out of most people. And so that's one of the problems with the Penry case, is because it cuts two ways. And that's a real, real narrow line that lawyers have got to cross when introduce that evidence, because at the same time, you're introducing evidence that may get the jury, make the jury want to give the death penalty because they're afraid the guy will repeat again. That's one of the real dangers of mental illness currently. I'd like you to comment on that.
And the jury is free to interpret that information any way they want to. Okay, Rick.
Yes, well, again, all of these issues intertwine themselves, from jury selection and who sits on juries and people who are predisposed to have little to no problem in sentencing people to death on these juries to fully informed juries and educated juries on these issues. This has clearly been going on for decades. It's not an issue that's going to be solved in a hurry. This is really an educational issue in part, and that's what makes this whole process so difficult. It's just not, I agree with Jim, it's just not black and white. There are just these complexities and nuances about subjects regarding an individual's mental health that most people, most jury members, have little to no familiarity or knowledge with. And it's just a very difficult thing.
Jim,
talking to a jury that's predisposed to kill, so again, how can we be surprised?
Yeah, what some of the listeners may not be aware of, I suspect we're a pretty sophisticated crowd out there, but first you qualify a jury on the willingness to impose the death penalty. And anybody in the room on that panel who is not willing to impose the death penalty is dismissed for cause. And then each side gets to dismiss from their impressions, and who's left over? People already who agree that they can impose the death penalty, so that's been prepared. And then the defense does the best job they can of sending them out to get heard, and then the process proceeds from there. What would happen in our system if we just took execution off the table? What has happened in those jurisdictions that have stopped killing?
Well, in this country, of course, the states do have an option. Every state that has the death penalty, jurors have a sentencing option of life without parole. So, you know, if you ask, well, if we just took the death penalty off the table or eliminated it altogether, I do think you would see a continuation of the trend that's been going on in this country for a good 10 to 15 years, which is long-term sentencing, mandatory 30, 40, 50 years with some possibility of parole, or perhaps just an increase in life without parole and the perpetual incarceration until death of convicted people. The sky is not going to fall. America is not going to collapse when the death penalty is abolished. People will still be sentenced to very lengthy or perpetual terms of imprisonment, and those who are innocent clearly will still be alive to have their cases hopefully found out in time.
Well, I don't necessarily think cable television is being very helpful by going in and showing all of this horrid gang activity and all of this new expose of what goes on behind bars. The experience in Texas has been a little bit different from that. It took some of us a decade to get Texas Department of Criminal Justice to accept a program whereby inmates in gangs could reject them and get into general population, have contact visits with their family, and make parole. And that has been an enormously successful program. It hasn't gotten through to all of them, but I sat in a room the other day where the chairman of the Texas Syndicate had processed out, and he was going to get to touch his daughter the following visiting day, and the guy was as excited as a teenage girl who got a date to the prom. And here was this big old bruiser that had been the head of one of Texas's most horrid gangs, and he was so proud of his grad program diploma and that he was being restored. He came back for another meeting to thank the guys for helping him. Doesn't sound to me like the killer stuff that I see on MSNBC and some of the other television channels.
You know, and again, and I'm just saying this as a historian with a broad perspective here. You know, we're currently in a situation in this country where obviously we have the death penalty, and we've had this institution in our country for 400 years. It's as normative as anything we've ever had. We cannot, the average person that doesn't think about it or doesn't care about it, we just as a society have a really difficult time imagining ourselves in a country which doesn't kill people, because this is so normal an activity, and I mean institutionalized, as a response. But there was a time when every other great moral wrong of this country was also seen in the same way. People could not imagine an end to slavery, but it ended. And people at one point could not imagine women ever getting the right to vote, but clearly it ended, or they got the right to vote. People couldn't imagine a nation with full integration where race didn't matter, but we've progressed to that point, of course. And this is no different. We cannot imagine ourselves in a nation that doesn't kill people, but that day is coming, however far away it is. And people, when that day comes, people will look back on us today the way we look back on Americans when these other great moral wrongs existed, and shake our heads in disbelief that we did this in the name of the law, the way slavery, genocide, and denial of all other rights was once done in the same name of the law. And history will bear this out, and it's just frustrating because it's not here yet, but it's coming.
Rick Halpern, activist, historian, Southern Methodist University. How do people get in touch with you, Rick?
They can email me here at the university, or call me through the history department. I'm easy to reach.
Thank you, sir, and we're glad to have you on Execution Watch tonight.
Thank you for all your work.
Thank you, Professor, and keep up your loyalty to the cause.
You bet. Take care.
Bye-bye. Remarkable man. I've known him for a good many years, and makes a lot of sense. And I'm remembering how, obviously, a man who's got a lot more gray matter than I've got, listening to his thoughts mature over the years. There used to be a bite of anger in his voice. That's all mellowed out, and it's just reason now, Jim.
I was wanting you to ask him how in the world he could stand an institution that had George Bush Library. That
yeah, I know,
tank.
I know, but
I, mean, God.
I don't do the gotcha show, Jim.
I was wondering how he could tolerate that George Bush think tank. Come on. Man.
That's a different department.
I understand.
However, I'd like to bring to the Baker Institute just about owns Rice University.
I understand that,
so
but they don't
watch it.
They don't dignify it.